Good morning, everyone. My name is Anna Gafanova, and I am a practitioner at SCI. And today, our special guest is Brian Ford. Good afternoon, Brian. And would you mind sharing a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you for the invitation, Anna. So yeah, my name is Brian Ford. I am probably best known as the host of the Self-Improvement Daily podcast. So I have a lot of impactful conversations myself. For the last 7.5 years, I've kept it up, 21 million downloads to date. And my intention is just to make a difference in the world. You know, I believe that if only we were to follow through on our best intentions and convert those into action, the world would be a much better place. So that's what I help people to do in social impact work and in their personal development. And as a former semi-professional athlete and collegiate athlete, I very much am plugged into how personal development is kind of interfacing within sports and sports leadership. It was actually, that was the purpose why I got into personal development in the first place, was because I was on a team and had the structure of, you know, organized sports. And then once I lost that and joined the workforce, I didn't quite have that same structure and I needed to create it for myself. So I'm very much an athlete trying to figure it out as I go.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Would you mind sharing a little bit more about your path in college and what brought you to sports to begin with?
Totally. Yeah. So I was always a good athlete. It's funny because I have an older brother who's 4 years older than me, and I always just wanted to be like him. You know, so he was playing hockey, I played hockey. He was playing soccer, I played soccer. He played baseball, I played baseball. And I just kind of followed in his footsteps. And what that meant was I was getting exposure to sports earlier than most kids would, because I just wanted to be like my big brother. And I was just naturally athletic and gifted. And I guess a combination of early exposure and skill allowed me to excel in sports. So, you know, I was always the team captain, the star athlete, all stars, you know, I ended up playing college soccer. That was the sport of choice. And, yeah, you know, played up a year, throughout my childhood so that I was kind of playing with older kids. I was trying to keep up with my brother and his friends who were 4 years older. So I was just kind of in that environment. And ultimately, you know, I was able to create enough success and opportunity for myself that I got a scholarship to play in college, you know? So I went to UC Davis and played Division I soccer at UC Davis, became the team captain for 2 years, and just like really leaned into, you know, being a student athlete and trying to excel in sports and in school, and had a great experience. We didn't win any championships or anything like that. You know, of course you want to. I guess we won one of the league championships, but not like the playoffs afterwards. So there was some, you know, good moments within that, but definitely formative times. And, you know, something that I know benefited me and benefits a lot of people is just the organization that sports provides and the leadership, the mentorship, the teamwork. It's just such an invaluable, you know, point of exposure. So I was a lucky beneficiary of that.
And you've mentioned that, you know, the goal of the podcast was to really navigate that transition after the teamwork versus being in corporate. So I think my question here is, how comfortable were you with the version of yourself outside of sports, right? So you have that background, you have the organizational skills, and you're part of a team, and that's it, like you leave. So how did that, could you walk me through that process and how that felt to you personally?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it is exactly that transition point that defined, you know, my new trajectory. Cause, you know, growing up, I was describing a little bit, but I was always like the guy, you know, I was always the star athlete, and it was easy and I was good and it was fun and I was rewarded for it and was reinforced for it. And then once I became, you know, once I joined the workforce, I realized that, you know, I had weaknesses, and that while I was able to work hard in sports and school and do really well, it required a new skill set, and I needed to provide for myself, and I needed to be able to drive my own growth and development. So really the moment that I kind of encountered that identity crisis that you're alluding to was, okay, who am I without the sports, and what do I do for the world? What am I known as? What do I want to be? And I didn't have a good answer for that because I was all wrapped up in, you know, who I used to be. And as I was trying to figure out who I was in this next chapter or phase of my life, it also came with being average for the first time, where instead of being the star, I was now, you know, I got a great job out of school, and, you know, it was actually an alumni of the same soccer program that I was a part of. So it helped me to get my first opportunity. But I, you know, I got a great job and then was in sales and medical device sales and was very average. And, you know, I was short of quota and trying to hustle to open doors. I was like, wait, but everyone, don't you know that I'm the guy that like everything is always just perfect. Like I'm always the stud, I'm the star. Like, and I had to kind of confront those two different identities of who I was accustomed to being and the new environment I was in where I didn't have the same skill set. And that's when I turned to personal development, where I was like, okay, cool. Either I can continue to be average, which is uncomfortable, or I can work on myself to try and get better. And that's where the podcast was born out of, was me just learning a lot for myself and then sharing what I was learning. And eventually people started listening and, you know, it's kind of become the forefront of my brand and my interests for the last, you know, 7.5 years.
Do you think the general like athletic departments or even professional teams, I feel like once you retire, God forbid you have an injury, it's such a big impact for so many people, regardless of age or the league or where you play. Do you think coaches, managers, or just the system needs to be better when it comes to personal development while the athletes are still active to smooth out that transition? Or do you think it's done well enough for the kids and for adults too?
Sure. Yeah, I think it can always be better. As you asked that, I kind of think of two different ways to answer that. So on one side, you talk about like, what are the resources people get as they transition? That's actually an interest that I have, you know, because I've been able to solve that problem for myself. And if I can program, you know, make it programmatic and hand it off to other student athletes or students that are transitioning into the workforce, like I wish that I was consistent in making a schedule for the day, that I had just like a relationship management database so I can keep track of everyone I was meeting, a task management system, like all these different pieces that I had to kind of like piecemeal together. It would have been great to just be like, hey, so these are all things that work, go. And I could start using some of those systems. Yeah. So that's one of the opportunities I see as part of the transition. The other thing that's interesting about what you're describing is when you're an athlete and when you're in school, you know, you build relationships with your teachers, with your coaches, whoever it is. And they're like, oh my gosh, they are so smart and they're so accomplished and they're heroes and they're amazing. And in that time of your life, that's exactly what they are. But then as you get older, you start to realize, oh man, he was 35 years old, or like he was, you know, going through a divorce, or he, whatever it was related to like a teacher or a coach. And it makes you realize how human they actually were and that they were playing the role of being this mentor or leader for you. Right. And it really kind of takes the pressure off for yourself. It's like, oh yeah, it's kind of like everyone's still always trying to figure it out, you know? So to that side, like, does personal development have a role? Of course it does, because all of us are trying to be better versions of ourselves. But at the same time, it's like, we're always going to be trying to figure it out. So that's the spirit I kind of think of.
I think it's so interesting to see how college athletes are perceived in the workforce. So I've come across companies that are just dying to hire a college athlete because of discipline, you know, just work ethic and that team, you know, skills, like working as a team, and just it's such a good asset to bring onto the team for so many big companies. On the other side, I know of a lot of people that don't want to come close to college athletes because for them, like, well, what did they study? What did they learn? They're more athletes than students, etc. Have you ever come across any situations where it was one or the other, where you felt either like put in a pedestal because you were a college athlete, or the opposite?
Oh, totally. I mean, I'm the byproduct of that. So the job that I got out of college, medical device sales, is known to be like a hot spot for former athletes. And that's because it's a sales job. And also you take an interest in the human body, right? And there's also an interesting dynamic within medical device sales, which is, you know, orthopedic surgeons and neurosurgeons were the people that I was working with because it was spine, you know? And there was this dynamic of, well, who used to be kind of the nerd in school, the smart kid that became the doctor. Now they love getting the attention of the popular kid, the athlete, the jock, you know? So it's like, it is an interesting dynamic where some industries naturally, you know, have some pull and appeal to former student athletes, you know? So I've seen that on one side. I also came from a university that is, you know, exceptional, you know, top 10 public school in the United States. So I think there is a certain understanding or expectation of, oh, if you went to this school and you were a student athlete, that means you must be a certain level of smart and you were also, you know, athletically gifted. I don't know that you can say the same. I don't have the experience of, you know, schools, the SEC or, you know, some of more powerhouse sports schools that don't have the same reputation academically. Yeah. Is there a bias to those students? Because it's like, oh, well, they just went to college because of their athletic ability. So that wasn't my experience. But I've found that at least all of my colleagues have had advantages in finding employment because they're student athletes versus any biases.
Okay. Let's pivot a little bit. I'm very curious to hear your opinion on the revenue share for athletic departments and international kids and how they're not able to take advantage of NIL and be part of that whole system. And you being a college athlete in the past, have you had any interaction with foreign players, maybe on your soccer team or outside? Just if you want to share, if you have anything to share about that and just your opinion, that would be
sure. Great. Yeah, I'm not super familiar with the differences between NIL access for international students or athletes versus domestic athletes. But what's interesting is the vantage point I do have is soccer is a very international game. So I grew up with kind of this awareness that a lot of athletes are going to be international. And there's even, you know, you talk about keeping amateur status. Back when I was in school, you had to maintain amateur status in order to be eligible to play college sports. And a lot of, you know, international players would be on these kind of professional, semi-professional gray area teams in their native countries. And then there was a lot of kind of like figuring out maneuvering to, was that legitimate? Is there any penalty or anything like that? So there's definitely kind of this gray area dynamic related to internationals, like athletes becoming student athletes in the States and just kind of like, you know, systems and pillars to kind of work around. In terms of NIL at large, I think it's changing the landscape. Of course, it's changing the landscape of college sports. I see both sides of it. I see on one side, there is economic opportunity for student athletes, yeah, which is great because if their likeness is being used and they're generating revenue for the university, they should have their ability to be able to be compensated for that.
Yeah.
At the same time, the counter argument is, you know, it's just seeing what it's doing for, I would call it the nationality or the pride that's taken in college sports. You know, now it's become more of a capitalistic choice for student athletes versus an allegiance to this is my school and my team and who I represent. So I feel like there's been some spoiling of college sports because incentives are different now. But again, with the upside that now, very high level athletes aren't being taken advantage of too. So that's, I think we're just in this gray area of trying to figure out what is the best of both of those worlds to be able to achieve both of those ends.
Yeah. I came across an article, a discussion more like on how regular students perceive the student athletes, right? Because for a regular student, you have to have the SAT scores or ACT and the grades and A levels or whatever it might be to get into, let's say, any university top 10. It takes a lot of time and effort to gain the level of academics to be allowed in, and then you get into debt and tuition and all of those things. And then for a student athlete, you have to work as an athlete, which is also very, very difficult. But normally you get a scholarship and you get all the perks and you still get the education. And also on top of that, now you're able to make money with NIL. So I think a lot of regular students that have put in the same amount of effort to develop their academia and actually be able to enroll in a college like that, they feel I don't want to say disappointed, but I think there is a degree of the stigma that is now being like brewing in the college space, because regular kids that are smart, they're like, well, why them and not us? Why can't we make some money due to our academic talents and whatnot? So what do you think about that?
Well, you're right. The economy has completely shifted, and I would actually argue, and here I am playing the on the side of the student athlete, right?
No, it's good. It's good. I like that.
But I think there's two different points to make. One is it's easier for anyone to make money in college than ever. Like there are TikTok accounts that are just going nuts and social media influencers. So there is this equal opportunity and access that the kind of technology and democratization of attention has really enabled. So it's not like, they have this opportunity. It's they maybe have a more direct platform that they can monetize, whereas someone else needs to create their own platform. And that's because a student athlete can borrow the credibility and media coverage, whatever that sports attracts, right? So that's kind of one side of it. The other related to this kind of like influencer landscape is that there are also kids who are creating these platforms for themselves and they don't know what to do with it. So who knows what the overall, like, what is the overall outcome and timeline of how these advantages or opportunities are going to materialize into their long-term well-being and sustainability, right? So it's kind of like the classic lottery winner example. You know, if you don't have the foundation built to be able to sustain the attention or the finances coming in or whatever it might be, then it could actually create problems in your personal life, you know? And so it's just like a difficult thing to navigate where you have these 18-year-olds that are put in the spotlight and they have all of, you know, the world resting on their shoulders. Do they have the self-worth to be able to maintain that? So just because there's economic opportunity doesn't mean it's the best thing for them. You know, there's a lot to consider and it's a macro trade-off. It's much larger than just a direct correlation.
Do you think that all the pressure that these student athletes are now exposed to under the spotlight, you know, some of the comments that I read under like football teams, they're horrifying. Like, and they're kids first, they're student athletes. Do you think there needs to be some more like just fundamental like filtering or control or whatever it may be of how the public and the fans view the kids, because it's some of the things that we see online are so absurd.
Totally. Yeah. I think it's a hard ask for fans to change their behavior because there are so many fans and who knows how you access them or get through to them. That's just like a much more difficult piece, which means that the intervention probably is on the side of the athlete, which is okay, prepare for the environment. This is what comes with it. You don't actually suck. People don't actually hate you. You know, it's just kind of, this is what comes with the territory and the education around that for, and I'm sure programs are offering that, you know, I'm sure that's baked into this like NIL landscape is, hey, let's make sure that your self-esteem is being maintained and that you're not selling your soul and just monetizing your likeness. Like you know, there's more to it than just you making money because you play sports, you know? So I imagine the resources are in place and being put into place further because again, we're all like learning how this works. So, so we're just going as we go.
And would love to hear more about the tips and tricks for, you know, personal development. So you've been in the industry for quite a while and you decided to pursue it because of the personal interest, right? So if I'm hearing correctly, it wasn't like a way to make money. That wasn't the goal. The goal was to learn more about yourself, understand how you can be better as a person. So what was some like maybe one or two biggest discoveries that you've had since starting this that, you know, could be applicable to athletes and not even athletes, just regular people?
Totally. Yeah. One of the things that is so obvious, but is underestimated is the law of cause and effect, right? Like we've all learned like, oh, there's cause and effect. You do this one thing and it produces this next thing. And what a lot of people don't realize or don't think about or don't value enough is our own ability to control the causes and inputs in our life to generate the effects that we want, right? So you talk about achieving a goal. You can't just set a goal and then sit there and cross your fingers and hope it happens. You've got to do something to change the relationship between the causes and the effects in order to generate that outcome, right? So that's one of the pieces where it's like, and this is the conversation around having agency and ownership in life, right? If you are responsible for absolutely everything in your life, that means that results are actually more in your control than you think. They're not guaranteed because cause and effect has factors that influence what happens that you don't control, that you don't have visibility into. That's just the way that it works. There's not a direct correlation between cause and effect. There's probability, right? So that's one of the first pieces, which then leads to, you know, another classic example of, you know, just defining success, right? That's what we're all chasing. That's a lot of people who are in personal development are looking to do, right? They want to be successful. They want to achieve a lot. They want to feel like their life is worthwhile, that they're applying themselves. And it's the classic example of, well, okay, you know, society's definition of success is that you're making a lot of money and you can afford the things that you need. And right. And you roll your eyes because we know that that's kind of true. And it's true and it's toxic versus, and this is something I'm learning, right? And I'm in progress with all of these things, which is how can I place my own perception of my performance on how well I executed the plan versus if the plan worked to produce an outcome, meaning treat everything in life as an experiment. And an experiment is successful, not if you got a certain result. That's why it's an experiment. Because you're trying to figure out what happens. Like that's what you observe and you're unattached to it. The experiment is, oh, let's see what happens. But you measure your own success by evaluating how well you executed the conditions that you decided upon for that experiment. So as we're talking about, controlling the inputs and measuring yourself on, did I do what was required given what I knew at the time in order to achieve this thing that I care about? But to find your self-worth and your own work ethic is enough because you executed, because you did it, you tried.
Do you think it's healthier to set goals that are more realistic? So for example, like I'm going to start $1 million business. That would be a very big goal. But rather have like mini goals that you, you know, have like bi-monthly or whatever it might be. It's like, I'm going to open an LLC. And then I'm going to do this. I'm going to hire my first person. Right. So how do you think, like, what do you think works better for human brain long-term when it comes to achieving things?
Yeah. So if you can even take a step back with goal setting and the intention around goal setting, it's really just to provide a direction for action. Like we cannot do anything but take action in the present. So the goal is just a lens that helps you to align and discern which things do I need to do to get there. And it helps you to kind of prune the distractions that may take up your time that don't actually contribute to the direction that you want to go. So with that in mind, then what is the right type of goal? Well, there are milestones between where you're at and that final goal that are helpful to know. Okay, I need to start my LLC. I need to get my first client. I need to bring on my first team member. I need to get my accounting in order, right? So those are meaningful goals and milestones. When I think of a goal, I think of it as a desired output or outcome or KPI to say, hey, and this is the direction and the, you know, the measurement that we're trying to build toward is a goal. Because then that allows you to know what are the things I need to do in order to execute toward that. And the framework that I like using are you have goals, strategies, and tactics, right? So the goal is the top of the mountain. It's where you're headed. It's where you want to go. The strategy is the trail that takes you up the mountain. This is the path. And that's the thing about strategies is there are an infinite number of ways to get to the goal.
Yeah.
But what you need to do is pick the one that you think is most likely to work for you. And then that's the strategy. And then from there, you figure out, okay, within that strategy, what are the actions and tactics I need to take in order to execute that strategy? Because to literally walk the path, that's how you get to the top of the mountain, not by knowing what path to take, but by walking step by step, and then you follow the strategy up to the top, right? So there's a lot of variability in all of that. And I think that's kind of one of the fatal flaws I'm seeing specifically in culture today, you know, as a coach who talks to a lot of people about their goals. The issue is that there are so many strategies and so many tactics that people bounce around and try and do all of them at once, or they don't do them for long enough in order for you to make meaningful progress. And that's where the discipline that's required to pick your strategy, commit that that's the most likely path for you to work, and to not waver on that path and be like, okay, cool, I'm going to keep working it. Because then that's the only way that you actually take your steps forward up the path toward the goal, right? So with that in mind, the orientation of, is it this goal at the end? Is it this goal halfway? Is this goal one step in front of you? All of them are meaningful. Because goals are only meant to orient your direction and the actions and the strategies and actions you commit to. So it really is a matter of preference. Some people are really on fire because they've got this huge mission that they're pursuing, and that gets them to wake up and be bold and take action. Then there's some people who get overwhelmed by that And it's, there's a matter of self-awareness to be like, hey, which one works for me? And then you get to, you know, design your pursuit accordingly.
I think echoing on what you just said about what motivates people, I think one of the largest, the hardest thing that people have to come work through is failure, right? So inevitably, when you work towards a goal, there are going to be setbacks. And some people just don't deal well with setbacks. Do you have any recommendations or personal strategies or what you say to yourself, you know, when something doesn't work out, and just tips and tricks for our audience on how to really navigate that well?
That is a huge question and such a good one. No, because it's such a problem. So it actually comes back. There's a few different ways to answer this. It comes back to what I was talking about with designing experiments, right? The reason that people feel like a failure is because they're attached to a certain outcome that they expect, and like, oh, and that's what I wanted and I didn't get it. And then they get emotional and it creates resistance because now there's disappointment, discouragement. Am I doing the right things? There's this doubt that comes with it. And what that does is it keeps people from getting into the next version of action. That is the next opportunity, their next chance at being able to achieve what they have in their mind, right? So there's that like first orientation to consider. The second one, you ask about a story. So here's a perspective I learned this past year about failure, which is I set this big goal. Right? I set this big goal. It's like, I'm going to raise $100,000 using personal development as a vehicle to do so around New Year's. I'm going to collaborate with some of the world's most influential people, build a custom program for them. We'll market it to all of their followers, and every dollar their followers invest in this program, we're going to donate to charity. That's how we get to $100,000. And I built it in public every single day. I was pre-committing. Hey, here's the influencer I'm reaching out to. This is the play that I'm running. I got this gift for them. I'm going to this event. I'm flying across the country. I'm asking for these intros. I'm bold. I'm brave. I'm terrified. I'm doing it anyway. And I document that all in public for everyone to see on Instagram. And it totally flopped. Like totally flopped. My goal to raise $100,000. I got one partner. I was hustling dozens, 20 plus influencers I was trying to partner with. One person said yes. And the activation around that was completely fumbled. So we had like six people sign up where it should have been hundreds, right? Public failure. That's why I bring this up. Public failure. This is what I learned from it. People respect that you tried way more than the result of your effort. Meaning I thought, oh man, people are going to think that I'm less serious. I should be taken less seriously, that I'm less valuable. People shouldn't collaborate with me because I can't get results. That was what I assumed. And that's why failure is so painful, because you assume that people are going to think less of you or judge you because of it. But what I found to be true was the opposite, that people admired it. They're like, wow, the courage to put yourself out there like that and to fall short and to keep trying and to be honest with it, to show us what it looked like as you got disappointed and rejection and you flew across the country and she blew you off or whatever it was. Like people are like, wow, that's real. And I earned their respect because of that. So failure is this thing where it's internal. We think it's a failure, but other people didn't view it that way. Other people viewed it as a success. I actually earned respect, which leads to like the last part, which is, okay, what's like a mantra or a mindset shift or a way to help people with relationship with failure? I learned this from Brian Johnson, a mentor of mine with a group called Heroic. And he's got this expression, which is either you win or you learn, and learning is winning so long as you learn, right? And that's what failure is. Failure is you didn't win. Failure is you lost. But if you lose and you learn, then you win. So if you can take that mindset into it with this curiosity-based experiment, which is, huh, that's interesting. I fell short. I lost. I didn't achieve what I wanted to. Why might that be? Oh, I could have done this better. Oh, that didn't connect. Oh, this mistake. Learning, right? And learning is winning. So either you win or you win, right? So it's easier said than done. When you have a failure, like I said, it's very emotional. You're attached to the outcome. It's hard. But if you can then separate from that to look at it more objectively, get curious, understand the cause and effect between what you did and what actually happened, then that helps you on your next attempt to put better inputs in to be more likely to succeed and to run a better experiment, one that's more likely to achieve the results that you desire. So failure is a huge topic, but that's the way that I've been thinking about it recently. And it seems to resonate with people when I share it.
This is wonderful. This is such a great and powerful way to end the podcast. Thank you so much for sharing. I think it's so useful to everyone. It's outside of sports, but we all go through failure every single day, and just remembering that it's just life and it needs to be taken less seriously sometimes, I think, and take it as a path and we grow. And Brian, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your wisdom on this topic. It was such a pleasure to meet you, and I'm sure our listeners will greatly appreciate the new wisdom.
Yeah, well, thank you, Anna. This was a treat to share.
Thank you so much, Brian. Bye.